recognized symbol of excellence in sports entertainment.
Welcome in to another edition of Monday Mailbag with Mr. Nick Patrick. I'm your host, Cassio. Nick,
boy, yes, sir.
We got a lot to cover, but how are you, man?
I'm doing great, man. Been staying busy. We had a show, and it turned out pretty awesome, man. I was really skeptical about doing it, and my crew kind of talked me into it, you know.
Because of the weather?
Yeah, because of the weather. I've never, you know, I put a post on Facebook. I said, if you'd have told me a week ago, right, you know, a week before the show, that I was going to promote the coldest show in wrestling history, I'd have told you it was friggin' crazy. You know, and I, you know, I was completely against it at first, you know, but the people that at the restaurant wanted to do it, we had fans contact us that wanted to do it. The boys wanted to do it. And I'm like, okay, you know, and it turned out really good. It turned out, you know, it wasn't our biggest crowd, but we wasn't expecting it to be, you know, we knew that it was going to be cold, but you know, but we found out who our hardcore base is. And we have a really good, strong hardcore base at that area right now.
That's awesome, man. And speaking of, our old buddy, mutual friend Road Dog got to stop by.
Yeah, he sure did, man. It was great to see him. And all the kids got to meet him. And when we gathered everybody together for a little team talk right before show kickoff, and he stepped into the enclosed area where we was at and talked to my crew, talked to all the kids, man. And I think that he left chill bumps on all their arms just getting to meet him, you know. But for him to come in there and give him a motivational speech, and they all went out there and they knocked it out of the park in the freezing cold, man. It was cold. There was one point in time, this one kid said it was down to 16 degrees. Oh my God. But I was telling you earlier where we was at, there wasn't a lot of wind, and the sun was really bright. Thank God. Cause if we hadn't had that sunshine, it would have been unbearable. But if you got out of the wind and stood in that sunshine, you was okay. You know, if you went and hung out in the shadows, you'd better been coated up, man.
I know Dog didn't get to stay for the show, but hey, how long had it been since y'all seen each other in person?
Oh man, it's been several years.
Decades,
maybe? Possibly, yeah. I mean, I saw his brother, but I hadn't seen him in a long time. And I've seen Steve more recently. He's come up and done a couple of shows up here in Georgia.
Yeah,
and I hadn't even really seen Scott either in a long time, you know. But I'm good friends with all those guys.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way the business is. You know, you run into each other and it's like you pick right up like you never missed a lick. You know?
Yeah, usually all, you know, same way for me in stand up comedy. My best friends, if everything's going good, they're working on a weekend and you're working on a weekend, so you don't get to see each other. So you got, that's how you can tell it's good. You hadn't seen each other in a while, and you just go, boom. Like
everybody's busy and everybody's happy and busy, yeah.
Well, that was crazy timing. He called me and said, man, I just happened to be driving through Atlanta, and I've got time to kill. He said, doesn't Nick do a weekly show? I said, no, it's not weekly, but I think he's doing one. And he said, well, I'm going to try to stop by. So that was perfect timing.
I had a call on my phone, and if I don't know who it is, hell, I don't answer. and his phone number was different than the last number I had on him. And I'm like, pfft. And then I saw a message. I said, okay, I see who this is. A message. He goes, hey, Brian James. I said, oh, hell, I called him right back. I said, and I was on my way, but I was like about an hour out, you know.
Yeah.
I said, hey, look, I'm going to be there in about an hour because, you know, I was down at home still. And, I had to boogie on down. It takes me about an hour to get there from where I'm at. If I was stuck at lights or traffic, you know, and there's no insane traffic. But man, it was great to see him, and it was such a surprise too. All my team thought that I cashed in a favor, because I had Eric come, and I've had different people come, you know, just because they wanted to check it out, and I said no, man. He just said he wanted to come by. And it was awesome, man. We went out there and worked on the coldest show in history, and those kids went home jacked beyond belief. Because I've got some other things coming up. I can't really talk about right maybe on this show, but on the next show, I should be able to let out some information that's going to be really cool about Deep South and about some of the players here.
Well, I know you got a show coming up on the 17th. We'll promote that before we get out of here. Yeah. But I wanted to get this question in, and I'm going to ask you, well, of course, the biggest topic in wrestling, but since we're talking about Deep South, Travis Babcock hit us up, whether he'll hit us our first question of the week. He said, Nick, you ever ref any matches for Deep South?
Yeah, I special refed a couple of times, especially the version of Deep South that was in McDonough, that was a part of the WWE. When I, if I was home on that Thursday, if I happened to be home on that Thursday, then and it was a lot of times that I was because of the which what the crew that I was on, then I'd go down there and I'd help pop in the back, and I'd, you know, just so that, because people recognize me, you know. And just, you know, like I'm going to say name power, like I'm like pulling people in. You know me, I ain't about all that about myself. But it was a name of somebody that they recognize, you know, and somebody locally that, you know, so I'd, you know, I'd come down and I'd do a match for them here and there. And but mainly I helped them in the back, you know, coming up with ideas for, you know, matches, finishes, and little angles to do with some of the characters that the kids had down there.
So, like, for this one you just had, the cold one, what's that day like for you? Are you backstage? Are you helping commentate? Are you just in the floating around?
I float around once it gets started, but at the beginning, when I first get there, I float around, let everybody know I'm there and say hi to people, and then I go backstage and we take care of, make sure everything business lined up wise, because my team is on. I got Eric Adams doing my booking for me, and he's, you know, by the time I get there, everything's lined up, man. He's there first, you know, and he's the one lined on to show up in the first place and does business with the DOS people. And he's right there helping, you know, assembling our students, helping ring crew and getting everybody in position where we need somebody for security here or somebody over there. And by the time I get there, because I'm taking care of folks, man. And then, you know, that's one of the reasons why I have people do so much for me. It's by the time I get there, I get there typically about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. I try to get there 2 hours before, but sometimes it don't happen. You know, if I get there about an hour and a half before and everybody, you know, everything's already lined up, and I'll go say hi to everybody, make sure everything's cool. If anybody's got any questions, if I got any new news to deliver to people or for anybody I need to pull off the side and talk to, I get all that done. Then I'll go get me some brisket or some turkey. Yeah, a couple sides and a couple of cold beers, because we're open. You know, it's business. Our performers don't get out there. Our wrestlers don't get out there and drink it on the job. But I'm cool with our announcers doing it because we got peer sponsors, as long as they don't get ignorant, you know.
Sure.
You know, which, you know, we're grown-ass men, you know.
Yeah.
And we love what we do. And so far I hadn't had a problem with anybody. And, it's good for the sponsors. And as long as we can keep it out in check. And there's been a couple of times that once it started getting later in the evening, the bucket that we had there would be full of empty ones. So that we curb folks, we run out, you know. So we curb folks so we don't have to get rides for them home.
There you go.
Yeah. But typically that's it. You know, when I watch the show, I watch the matches from different viewpoints, and I'll come back when the kids come back, I'll buzz them, what was good, what I'd like, what I didn't like. And there's not a whole lot that I don't like, you know, because we pretty much, you know, we pick kids that they're with the program that we're putting together. And I don't get too bent out of shape unless it's something way out, but you know, we know what's going to happen. So nothing way out happens, but I don't mind people going outside the box and trying things. You know, every now and then it's going to fail, you know, or if Pop told me when I was young, he said, when you get into business, you're going to try things. And so they're going to fail. He said, don't worry about it, because it's a learning process. If you don't go out and fail and fall on your ass every now and then, you're not trying.
Yeah.
You know, so I try to keep that in mind with kids when they try something new or different, you know, because a lot of times it's something different and it works and you think, oh, yeah, that was pretty cool. But if they did this, this might amp it up a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So I like letting people do their thing so I can critique it and then mold it to what we're doing, because they know what we want before they go out there. But I want their creativity and their spots and their moves. I don't want cookie cutter mold matches or talent, you know. That's why it's good that we draft people that are already, mostly for the most part, already been training, already working. And, we have some of our students that we bring in, you know, the ones that are ready, that are good. And we bring them into different positions that they're ready for. You know, we'll have them. Like, we got a couple of kids that are still really, their ring skills are still are coming along really well, but their timing and psychology still has to, you know, kids nowadays are just so, they just want to do spots, you know, spots. But I'm like, wait a minute now, you can cut about half of that crap out if you do this one thing that you want to do and do it right and sell it and take your time and let the people react to what you've just done, then you don't just have to go, boop, 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 you know, and, yep, and keep it going. And, you know, they don't ever really get a chance to, you know, they get a little short clap and you're already off on something else. You know?
Yeah.
It's, you know, you got to mellow out a little bit, dude. You know, but that's basically what I do. I watch, I stick around to the end, and I'll have a beer or two and talk to people. I like going through the crowd and watch the reaction of the people. I always loved doing that back, you know, when I was working at the A level, you know, whenever I was in there, and or when I wasn't in the ring and the show was going on and there was other refs in there and there was matches that there were certain matches that I would like to watch, but there was other ones that I wanted to hear and feel, you know, and I'd go somewhere where nobody could see me, but I could hear and feel everything that the crowd, you know, you could, cause I'd know what was going on, you know?
Yeah.
And you could say, okay, I know where they're at, and you could feel the reaction. And that's when you know things are working. You know, what's cool is if you sneak off like with RVD and you're sitting out in the car and you're out in the car and you hear the people go, wah! Yeah, you say, okay, okay, this is what they're doing. We need to get in there. We got 10 more minutes. Yeah, we need to ease on back in, dude.
Well, let's hit the topic of the day that is dominating the wrestling world. And I have no idea what your reaction will be and what you want to say, but I do think, just due to the timing of this show dropping and the headlines that are abound, we do need to at least bring it up to you. Vince McMahon, of course, in a lawsuit, a very detailed lawsuit that is just insane to read about and hear about.
Yeah.
Lawsuit for him and the WWE. So there's a lot to sort out there. I won't go into all that. But just what was your reaction when you saw this headline? We're right here on a, you know, a huge weekend for the company, and boom, this lawsuit drops out of nowhere. Nobody saw it coming, and it was a, you know, it's just dominated the headlines since it came out.
When I heard about it, I was actually surprised that it hadn't happened earlier and that there hadn't been a whole lot more people come out. That was my initial thought when I, you know, when I first heard about it. As far as some of the details, I hadn't actually read everything, but I've had different people tell me some of the stuff, and I've seen some of the things on Facebook, and some of it's just outrageous, man. You know, it's just
unreal.
Like, you know, wow. You know,
what do you mean by
I
think
would never let myself get into that position. You know, that's just insane. But he's always lived his life like he was above the rules, you know, like he was almost, you know, you've seen him mock God and stuff on TV, you know, and I, you know, I'm not a Bible thumper. I'm not going to thump anybody over the head or try to, you know, but I believe, you know, and there's certain things you don't play with, man. And I just think that, especially Laurinaitis. I have a deep dislike for John Laurinaitis.
Okay.
And it stems back to the way that WWE treated my parents with the Deep South training thing that Pop did with them. You know, it had become a super giant pain in my dad's ass. And at his age and at that stage of his life, he didn't need that, man. You know, and it was his money that was invested in his TV. And there was just a lot of things going on. And it wasn't the fact that they closed Deep South and left, because that was cool. If they would have just come to him and said, hey, Jody, this ain't working for us or for you. You know, we want to go somewhere else and start fresh in this. Yeah. So we're going to shut this thing down here. That would have been no problem. That would have been cool. That would have been business. But instead, what they did is that John had, I think it was Tom Pritchard, contact all the kids, and everything was supposed to be kayfabe, and they went there after hours because they had keys to the place too. And they went in and they cleaned out whatever belonged to WWE so that when Pop was supposed to show up the next day to work, it'd show up to a warehouse that was half empty.
Wow.
And that's how they've treated my parents, you know. And but I would never say who, but because there was more than one. But Pop was contacted and let them know what was going on, why they were in there loading. And Pop has his license to carry, you know. So he showed up and he was carrying. And when he showed up carrying with the big ass pistol on his hip, and he let them know, say, look, I know we're having a little falling out here, but here's the deal. Take whatever's yours and go with you. But I'd be damn sure you didn't touch anything that belonged to me.
Wow.
And they went, yes, sir. No, sir. Yeah, well, yeah, all that who shot John bullshit, you know. But to me, that was a cowardly chicken shit backstabbing pussy bitch way to treat a veteran that did nothing wrong to them. And they'd been over backwards to try and do everything that they asked him to do. You know, I mean, be business, be respectful, you know. But when they did that to my parents, at that point, I had lost all respect for them. And they even had trouble looking me straight in my eye. And I kind of pushed the issue whenever I could. I was hurt for a little while, and I kept back and forth. And I'd show up out of the blue, like when they'd come to Atlanta. And I'd walk right up to them, to Steffi and all of them, and you know, come right up in their face and shake their hand. Like, how are you? Good to see you.
Yeah.
Because you know, they were having that kind of trouble with me because they knew how shitty they treated my family, you know. But Laurinaitis, he didn't have a problem. He was just a dick. Whatever happens to him, he has coming, you know, no matter how horrible it is. Because to be quite honest, I truly believe I don't have any fats because I wasn't around any of that crap, man. That wasn't my now. But anything that happens to him, he's got coming, man. And to be honest with you, I think that they're really just scratching the surface right now.
Why do you say you're surprised that it didn't come out earlier and more people?
Well, this is because it's had, I mean,
suspensions and whispering or what?
Oh, well, this isn't something that's just happened here within the last couple of years. I mean, this goes back, if you go back decades, you know, they've covered up sex scandals as far as way back, you know, but they didn't really ever involve Vince back then, you know, that I knew of. But it's crazy. And finding out all that stuff happened now, I understand why I didn't fit into that clique.
Yeah.
And I'm glad
that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, I wasn't so well, you know, there's just something about me. No, I'm damn glad I don't fit into that thing, man.
Well, we'll see as the headlines change. This is bound to change every single day. So we'll see what happens in this ongoing story.
I'd really like to know exactly, you know, how much money really has been paid out over the decades to keep folks quiet, you know, because he's a wild ass. And he thinks he's above everybody. He's got that God syndrome. He thinks he is God, you know, and that he can do what the hell ever I want because I'm doing some kind of crap. You know? Yeah. But, you know, after a while, you know, everybody can fall, you know. So I don't wish bad on anybody except for Laurinaitis. I can't stand that some bitch.
All right, let's get into some more questions as we did slip in one earlier, but. Let's get into some fan questions and see what they want to hear about. Jesse Huffman said, Nick, how did it come around for you to be the NWO ref? Who do you remember talking about that first? Somebody Kevin come Sullivan. To you with that idea? Kevin Sullivan?
Yeah, it was his idea, and he came to me and asked me if I would like to do that. And, you know, we didn't know how far it was going to go. We just had the beginning, you know. I wanted to be able to show them that I could do more than just be a referee, you know, because I had done it before with, you know, with my dad's company. And, you know, and a lot of times referees don't get a whole lot of respect or kind of considered the underneath the totem pole, you know, and, you know, I wasn't going to be treated like that all my life or my career. I wanted no one. It's kind of boring if you can do more than that and you don't show it and you just keep back, you know, why, you know, so I wanted to be able to prove that I could do more. And just than just ref. You know, I could promo, I could bump, I could work, I could have man, I could do what the hell ever you need me to do. Because I've basically done just about everything in this business except for get rich and retire. You know, so I should have that made into a t-shirt.
It's a great t-shirt. I've done everything in this company but get rich and retire.
Yeah.
That's great. Alex Wheaton, shout out to Alex. I just saw him over Royal Rumble weekend down in Tampa. Alex said, Nick, have you ever tried peanut butter and jelly on a bacon cheeseburger?
No, but I saw that there's a restaurant that's got that out now, bacon, peanut butter and something on their cheeseburger. I saw that and it was puzzling to me. I'd have to try a small one first. I'd hate to get, you know, get a $20 burger and two bites in the oven. God, you know, what was I thinking?
But you know, peanut butter on a burger.
But I like the taste of all of those things.
Yeah,
you know, individually, you know, I would try it. Yeah. I'd try it. But I'd like, you know, I'd like to if they had a mini crystal burger.
Yeah, we need sliders. Yeah,
you know, them little White Castle looking burgers. I'll try that.
I've never had the jam. Now, do you do like jelly on your sausage biscuits or anything?
Yeah, I like Greek jelly on my sausage biscuits.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
No cheese, just the sausage, the biscuit, and some grape jelly, man.
I'll do mustard or jelly, either one.
Yeah, mustard's good. But the grape jelly is, man, and strawberry jelly is okay with it, but for some reason, grape just hits it with the sausage,
it
man.
It does. It hits better for sure. Speaking of food, Bobby, KF5GTX, saw him over the weekend. He said, Nick, what was your go-to food on the road? Was there a place you like to stop at the most?
Cracker Barrel a lot.
Cracker Barrel.
A lot of Cracker Barrel. Anytime we could find a good Japanese place or sushi place, depending on who I was riding with. You know, I did a lot of traveling with Teddy Long. I said,
he liked the sushi?
Oh, yeah. Me too, man. We sit down. We can ring a bill up at sushi bar. and my old buddy Mickey J that passed away. He used to love it too, man. We'd travel around. We'd find different places that had good sushi bars and go hit it. And that was one of the cool things about traveling. You know, you have some downtime. You got to eat sometime, so you try to find some pretty cool places that you. You know, and when you get home, you kind of get in the rut of eating at the same places all the time. You know, you pick the ones that you like, and at least I do. You know, I'm very habit, you know, creature of habit.
Yeah.
And then, but when you get out on the road, sometimes you have to try something different. Sometimes you find some pretty cool shit that way, man.
Let's see what we got. Simon C says, Nick, any memories or fun stories from working ECW One Night Stand 2006?
The most fun I had was when RVD showed me where to stand in the crow's nest where nobody could see you. We stood up there. There's a place where you can get up there and you can see all the crew working. You can see the people and you can see the ring. And you're like, holy crap, I didn't know this was here. And you look and there's be empty wine bottles of shit on the ledge. And you're like, dude, we're like five stories up. How the hell did they get up here on this ledge and be, you know, you can tell that somebody had been sleeping up there. It looked like, you know, but, we would sit up there and you can have a smoke if you wanted to or whatever, but it was like one of the places where you could watch and nobody could see you, but you could watch and feel everything that was going on. You know, that was my biggest memory. I remember I was so stressed because I drove downtown, had to find a place to park, you know, and anytime you have to drive downtown in New York or downtown Manhattan and park and get around, you know, it's a stressful situation. At least it is for me. So some people love it, you know, but driving around those big cities that you're not familiar with and oh, man, I remember that. But as far as the show wise, I remember Rey Mysterio doing some incredible stuff at that show. Like I said, when you do so many shows, you don't remember. And I remember he was one of the people that got a huge pop because they were popping big for the ECW people that were on there. But they had some other people that weren't, you know, traditionally ECW, and they didn't get as big of a reaction, but Mysterio damn sure did.
The main event featured John Cena and RVD, Rob Van Dam, for the WWE Championship. Yeah. You were not the starting ref, but as the chants got higher for Cena, they were very anti-John Cena, F.U. Cena, same old shit, overrated, you can't wrestle. After that, the ref got accidentally clotheslined by Cena, and you had to come in and officiate the remainder of the match. And then at the end, someone in a motorcycle helmet interfered, speared Cena through the table, and it turned out to be Edge, and Edge knocked you out as well. And Paul Heyman had to come to the ring and count to three. What do you remember about that chaotic match?
Now that you spelled all that out to me, I do remember that happening now. But once I got bumped and I was out of the way, I'm down. I'm trying to stay out of the way, out of camera shot and out of stuff. But I am watching to make sure, because just the old school in me from back in the day when you had to watch people jumping, before we had rails and stuff, and people would just interject themselves into what we're doing. You know, I'm still out there part of the match. So if I'm laying down there selling, and I have to stay out of the way. And sometimes when you're down there selling, we've got earpieces on, and they're telling us to deliver a message to somebody. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm down selling. They just shot me out of the cannon through the wall. You want me to come run over there? You know, but you have to get in position and watch where the cameras are and do different stuff, you know. But yeah, I remember. I do now that you spelled out all that happened. I can't remember that happening. Now it got a hell of a pop. Yeah. I know that there was earlier in the night there was a couple of people that struggled getting the pop, and I knew that they hated Cena there too.
Right.
You know, that's just when all that they just hated him, because that was a straight up ECW crowd at that building.
Yeah.
You know, when you ran the Garden or that. There's another theater inside
Hammerstein Ballroom.
Yeah, the ballroom. Yeah, if you run that, even the ballroom's got a little bit more of an ECW crowd feel to it, you know. But that one, that Manhattan Center, that I think that's what it's called, where they did that pay per view with the ECW pay per view. That was straight up all hardcore ECW folks.
And then of course they, you know, you get to Philly and it's all ECW there.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Let's see what we got. Mitchell Barnett is next. He said, Nick, you got any good Fit Finley stories?
Oh, Fit is awesome. He's a river. He's so funny. And he's one of the guys that you don't want to mess with. But you don't want to mess with Fit. he broke a guy's thumb in a bar in Germany, this big giant, big, muscled up badass that was missing. He called out Fit for some reason, and the guy reached out to grab Fit, and Fit just went boom and snatched him and snapped his freaking thumb. Oh. And the fight was over, you know. It didn't really turn into a fight. Oh. Yeah. And Fit would do this thing in the bar with kids and say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We got this spoon. Now, I'm going to bend over. He said, I'm going to show you what you do first. He said, you put the spoon in your mouth and you bump it up and down. And when you're ready, you hit me on the back of my head with the spoon. We see who can hit each other the hardest with the spoon. So he lets the kid go first, you know, and the kid puts the spoon in the mouth and, you know, it doesn't really do squat, you know. So then turns to Fitz's turn. And Fitz gets ready. He pulls that spoon out and goes flap on the back of the head and puts it back in his mouth. And they look at him like, oh, God, man. And here he sits with the spoon in his mouth.
He's like, keep going. See how
long. Yeah. Then do it again, kid? No, I don't.
That's great. The spoon trick. Very nice for Pat Finley. Great mind for the business as well.
Still? Tremendous. Yeah. Yeah. If you had a chance to work with him, I used to get tickled too. We had worked with a green kid. If you work with somebody that is at the level of Fit Finley, you just shut up and listen and do what. Hey man, what do you want to do? You know, what do you want to do? But there were some other kids that would come up to him, and I would listen to this, especially if I had their match. I'd really love it. I'd just say, okay, I'd like to do this, and I do this, and try to line all that shit up, and Fit would just go, yes, okay. I like it. Mm-hmm. Yep. I love it. Yep. Good. And then go out there and he wouldn't do none of it. Not one damn thing that kid said in a day. I'd be laughing my ass off. he was great. He was somebody, yeah. Man, if you had a chance to work with him and be in a program and just be around him and be trained by him, he is like a great mind to the business and one of the best workers, as good a worker as ever, you know, and especially in Europe, you know, he was huge in Europe, you know, as far as timing and psychology and moves, man, he's as good ever of a heel, you know, baby face. But as far as a heel, man, I've watched him do some things, man. And that cat can go, and he's got timing and psychology, and everything he does, he makes it mean something. He ain't out there wasting time or moves or spots. He tells you a damn story and pulls you in quick. You know, he knows how to hook you quick and keep you there. And he's the one that turned the ladies division around. Now, I mean, he's the one that trained all those ladies. Now, if you want, the ladies are as big as the guys now. They do everything that the guys can do. And if it wasn't for Fit Finley training them and teaching them and making them just like the guy, they wouldn't be pulling main events at WrestleMania now. They'd be at a certain level on the card. There'd be a gimmick match on the card. Now they are pulling. They can tote the mail if they need them to now. And that's because Fit Finley trained them up to that.
Batista, of course, said he was the unsung hero and requested Fit Finley induct him into the Hall of Fame. And like you said, just changed the Divas. They were the TNA and the bras and panties, and then he turned them into actual wrestling matches. And
they made some of them killers, man.
Yeah. He changed that game. And of course, he's still doing work, a trainer and assistant coach down at the Performance Center. So, good to see. As long as he's in the business, that's a good thing.
Yeah,
if he's still going, that's good.
Whoever gets trained by him has been trained solid.
Mike Barnes said, "Nick, hope you both are well. My wife is due in July.
Congratulations! Just
if you had any tips for a first-time father, thanks. I will say first, congratulations as well, and I will sit this one out. All I have is dogs, and if it's like anything like dogs, just feed them in the morning and feed them at night." And let him poop. But you are a father. You can give him some tips being a first.
I'll tell you what, this is crazy. And it worked for both of my kids, man. I used to talk to them while they were in. I'd just lay down next to my wife's belly and I would talk to them. And they get used to the sound of your voice. And then you can actually see the baby. When you can see sometimes them start moving, they'll move towards your voice.
Wow.
You know, and that was just so amazing to me. And when both of my sons were born, once they got them and cleaned up a little bit, they were crying and they handed them to me. I started talking to them, saying the same things that I did to them when they were still inside their mama. And both of them stopped crying and started turning their little bodies toward me, coming toward my voice when I did that.
Wow.
And it was the most incredible feeling. And it worked with both of my sons. So I highly suggest doing that, man. It'll be a feeling that the birth of your child is something that it's like, you know, that's all time high anyway. But to be able to get that reaction from a baby that's just popped into the world and is crying and there's a new atmosphere and all, but knows your voice and comes to it, man. It's an incredible feeling. It's something you got to try. I highly suggest doing that.
Congratulations, Mike.
Yes, sir.
Look forward to that, and congratulations to you and your wife. Adam Krasnoff said, was Chris Jericho always slated to be your opponent at World War III 1996? When you turned the heel and aligned with the NWO, do you know if there was any other names that were tossed around as potential pay-per-view opponents for you?
No, I was they were pushing him, and it was more me in there to get him over than him to get me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was more of that. I had enough heat on me where they could, it would help. It would benefit somebody, a babyface getting over to get, you know, to play off of that heat. And he was meant for, you know, that was meant for him for the whole time. And, that was awesome. That was one of the highlights of my wrestling. You know, the NWO stuff was fun, but as far as having actual matches, that was so much fun. And he lined up everything A to Z. You know, we got together and we went to a concert together and got to know each other a little bit. And I knew he was going to be a star, you know, and I said, this is your deal, man. You tell me what you want to do, I'll try to not blow up on you, you know. And so he lined all that up. The only thing I really suggested at the end was the actual finish where they wanted me to cut him off a little bit, you know, and they had me cut him off a couple of times because I had to get a little bit of heat just so right. he could, you know, get it back on me, you know. But that little deal at the end where I shut him down and I went to climb up off the I climbed up the top rope, and he come running up and grabbed me by my shirt and boom, slung me off and then hit me with the kick, and that was the finish. Me going up the top and having him grab me and slam me off the top, that's really about the only thing I come up with. Well, everything else was everything else was, you know, because I thought it would set up the kick and I'd just be dead. You know, I didn't realize I'd be so blown up, but I didn't know if I was going to make it up that day. But yeah, man, that was a lot of fun, man. And he was a great kid. I knew he was going to be a star, and he's lived up to it.
Do you remember what concert you went to?
Yeah, it was G3 down at House of Blues in Orlando. We saw Satriani.
Oh yeah.
Steve Vai, Eric Johnson, and oh man, the kid that plays like a little bit like Stevie Ray Vaughan, real young kid from Texas.
Kenny Wayne Shepherd.
Yeah. That's who.
Man, that's some guitar beater,
man.
Right
yeah,
there, buddy.
Yeah, well, yeah, because I played a little bit, you know, and then yeah. he was in the band thing too, and I want that was, you know, I admired all of those guys, man, and so that's where we went. We checked
that's
that
a
out.
That's a cool show, man.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see what we got. He also said, Adam said, Nick, do you have any memories that stand out from any of the spring break nitros at Club La Vila in Panama City, which iconic with the spring break nitros. Those seem like they were a wild time.
Yeah, they seem like it, but we was always more, you know, we wasn't out there, you know, spring amongst breaking. It had a really cool feel, you know, and it had the water gimmick around it. You knew somebody could take a bump in the water every time yeah. you went there somehow. It was a cool vibe, you know. It was fun, actually. You know, it wasn't different. Outdoor shows, if they've got a different atmosphere, a different look to it, can be really cool. You know, like that Huntington Beach show that we did one time. It had a ton of people out there. But, man, when we did that Huntington Beach show, I've had people throw shit at me, hit me before. But somebody took a water bottle and filled it with sand and chucked it. And it hit me right between the shoulder blades. And I swear to God, it knocked me to one of my, I went down to a knee and I come up and it knocked the breath out of me. But you know how it is when you get hurt, it's fight or flight. And I come up swinging and cussing, man. And I went and grabbed the rope like I was going to come out there and kill somebody. But there were several thousand people out there. How the hell did I know through that damn thing? You know, and you got to be careful too. You act too much of a damn fool, then everybody gonna start throwing shit at you. You know,
sure.
So, you know, but man, I'll never forget. I've seen Randy Anderson get knocked out with a golf ball one time. Somebody chucked one from up and it went bing and bounced right off his head, and he went bing. It's dropped, man. It's you know, he come back around, you know, a second later, but he was down for a second. You know. Hold his head, had a big old damn goose egg on his head. And that's crazy, man. People used to get all wrapped up.
That's dangerous. Thomas Panucci's got a couple questions for us. He said, Nick, did you ever feel that your own considerable size and height lessened the auras or the magnitude of the wrestlers in the match? If so, did you ever work around that challenge or did you just roll with it?
I just rolled with it. I was, for the most part, most of the guys was bigger than me. You know, there was, you know, different size guys, but, you know, I was, you know, during the 80s, when I was coming through and trying to work, well, that was the size that when the monsters, the gas monsters started being prevalent in the business, you know, and I wasn't bigger than them by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, how tall are you? You're pretty tall.
I'm 6'1". And
some of the cruiserweight, you know, WCW.
Yeah, well, what I would do when I worked with them is I would try not to stand like right up next to them, and I wouldn't purposely try to tower over them. And if I come and raise their hand, I'd stand off to the side and raise it off to the side some, you know. And so, you know, it wouldn't, you know, little things like that, you know, that I wouldn't be honest with you. I didn't really think that much about it because usually those guys were working with guys that was way bigger than them anyway. Yeah. You know, and
we knew they were cruiserweight, so we knew they weren't the biggest guys.
And if it was somebody like a Benoit, they had that attitude, yeah, well, like mess with me or watch me grow type of thing, you know, then size didn't matter, you know.
Yeah.
He could have fought a Godzilla. And Godzilla had to sold if he laid it in.
Thomas also had another question. He said, what was the mood like behind the scenes during the dying days of Georgia Championship Wrestling, the Ole Anderson, Thunderbolt Patterson tag title reign era?
Well, back then, business was in cycles. You know, it was like a little roller coaster ride, up and down, had the peaks and valleys. You know, and it was a struggle at the time, but I always felt that it would come around because I'd seen it come around before. And it was just a matter of time. But there were certain things that was happening there at the end. And then Crockett ended up buying it out and taking it over. And at the end there, I actually was excited because I was breaking in and becoming a wrestler at that point in time, which is what I always wanted to do. And they did an angle with me with Bob Roop, where he didn't like a collar or something, and he broke my wrist, and I wore this gimmick arm brace for a while, you know, big cast gimmick, and I challenged him to fight. I had my first matches were street fights with Bob Roop, and his deal was like, you can't last 5 minutes with me, and I said okay, you know, I accept the challenge, and we'd go, and I'd run, and he'd have to catch me, and I'd run in and out, finding it. As he'd coming through, I'd light him up, pow, pow, pow. He's going to get me, I'd run. And finally, he'd catch me and beat the living shit out of me. You know, but now the time is starting to run out, and the time is counting. I'm hanging onto them ropes for dear friggin' life, you know. I make the 5 minutes and win the match. And then he'd say, he challenged me to 10, and I'd do the same thing at 10. And then at 15, he just was beating the third comeback match, you know, he just beat the living dog shit out of me. And I had juice and everything. And he had an angle going with Ronnie Garvin at the time, Hands of Stone. And they did a deal where he had me beat the crap out of me, and he went to scoop me for a slam, and my feet hit the ref. Ref went down, and he slammed me. And then he scooched around and set me up, was going to pile drive me. While I was upside down, Garvin slid under the ring, come up with a big punch. And he fell back with me on top of him. And the ref turned around, and there I was. Juiced, laid out, knocked out, but I'm laid on top of him. 1, 2, 3. You know, and then Garvin helped me out. You know, and then I started working at that point in time. But those were my first matches, was like street fight matches with Bob Roop, and it was really cool, a lot of fun, man, a lot of fun.
Well, you brought him up. This is perfect, Ronnie Garvin. We got a question about him and. Ad Free Shows had a Top Guy get together for Rumble weekend this past weekend, and Ronnie Garvin showed up, and
right.
I got to meet him. I'd never met him, and he punched me in the nose. So,
oh my god,
he does have hands of stone. I will attest. I took a shot from Ronnie Garvin, but sweet guy, awesome guy, great mind. And but Tony Flowers has a question, and it works up perfectly since you brought him up. He said, what's up, guys? Nick, did you have a chance to work with Ronnie? You just said, but said, any insight you can provide us into the type of guy he was back then?
Ronnie was Ronnie was a wild man. He worked out hard. He trained hard. But Ronnie was, man, he would save his money. We had a contest back then to see who could make it through the week and spend the least money. And he had us, and he would drove all the time, you know, and he had us checking into these flea bag bringing hotels we lived like bums. At the end of the week, he'd spend like less than $100, you know. Like, how did you do that, you know? So he was one of the guys that worked out with me when I was starting to do the thing with Bob Roop, and they wanted, you know, to get me ready. And I'd show up to some different towns and get in the ring with different guys. Like Brad Armstrong, Tim Horner, Ronnie Garvin, and Buzz Sawyer. They would show up early and they'd work out with me. That's a hell of four guys to help you, you know. So, but Ronnie, man, he was from Canada too, and he could drive his ass off in snow and different places. So we let him he would scare you to death. And he was one of those guys, and you've heard probably Teddy talk about it before, you know, the guys mess with you. If you act scared, they just turn it on even more. So you got the no sell stuff with Ronnie, or he's going to turn it on. But there was one time we were going from Columbus, Ohio to Cincinnati, and a blizzard hit, and they ended up shutting down the highway, but we went anyway. And we're flying down. I mean, he's doing like 70. And I'm like, and we had a car because he asked for a car to have front wheel drive. He knew what to ask for. And we're rolling down the road, and he passes a freaking state trooper. And the state trooper looks at us and tried to tell us to slow down. And he's like, oh, fuck no. And it kept going. I'm like, oh, dear God. You know, here we go. And that trooper just like, he tried to follow us for a while. He let us go. He's like, oh, these dumb motherfuckers are going to die. But we didn't. And we were the only people that made it to the town. And instead of just staying there, we turned around and drove all the way back through the shit and made it with no problem. He's just driving. I'm like, but man, if he saw that, if he went, oh, God, really, then he'd go 10 mile an hour faster. You know, so I just got to where I would get me a little six pack and I had me a little smoke, you know, and I'd get into my little zone. And, you know, I didn't freak until like just the moment before impact. You know, so that's how I had to treat that whole situation.
Did Ronnie, you ever fly with him? He's an
expert. No, pilot. I wouldn't know. After being in a car with him, I thought, hell no, I won't get it. But I heard he was an awesome pilot, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, I'll have to take your word for that because I've been in the car with him and I ain't getting in the plane with him. I'll tell you that right now.
He told a great story. It makes sense now that you say that because he told a story this weekend about the Rock and Roll Express flying with him. And he said he knew they were going to hit major turbulence, but he didn't tell them on purpose. He just tightened his strap. He kept telling them to put their seatbelt on, and they wouldn't do it. You know, they're just back there hammering around. So he just tightened his up, flew through it, and they dropped a few feet, started slinging. He said they were holding on to each other's legs, bouncing around, saying, "You're going to kill us. We're going to die." All he said was, "I told you to put your seatbelts on." So he flew until 2003. He started doing freight after he retired from wrestling and got out of it. So that's
He told me a story about losing lights or something. He was having to fly with his flashlight reading maps, and he accidentally flew over airspace at Fort Bragg or something, and they big spotlights from the fort come up and hit the little plane and stuff. You know, it's that he told me that story. I love Ronnie to death, and I heard he's an awesome pilot, but I wouldn't do that, man, after being in. No.
Why was he so successful? Was it mentality? Was it in-ring? What was it, you think?
He had psychology, and everything he did looked solid and looked believable. He didn't do 1,000 things, but everything he did looked real.
Right.
Even that little stomp-around thing he did. Every stomp looked like he was stomping the crap out of the guy. You know, and I mean, that's kind of a silly little gimmick, but it worked. You know, he would stomp them all the way down their arm, down their body, down their legs,
all the other side,
all the way around their whole body, just stomp the shit out of them, you know. But it worked, and everything he did was solid. You couldn't see through it, you know. It wasn't like he had the greatest promos in the world, but it was believable. You know, to me, he had you believed he was hands of stone. You believed he was a rugged fighting kind of guy. You know, he portrayed that image, and he was, you know, easy gimmick for him.
not many people went over Flair. So good for Ronnie Garvin, man. An excellent career for Hands of Stone there. And thank you for the question, Tony. That lined up perfect for this weekend. Simon C. Said, Nick, when refereeing for TV, how much are the producers in your ear, and can it be distracting?
It can be distracting, but usually they're not in there unless things fall apart. You know, sometimes they'll give you a little cue, you know, to say, okay, tell them they need to get into the heat, you know, because they know the timing and they need to start getting toward that heat, you know, or they need to set for this comeback because they know the comeback is going to take a certain amount of time. They need to get rolling to get this comeback, you know, little things like that, you know, and it's not really distracting because it's part of the job. You know, if you had them sitting there and they started just talking crap, you know, and you were trying to work, then it would be distracting, but they're not, you know. And so you're getting time cues and pace setting cues usually. Yeah. My dad used to rip me a little bit when he would be on there because he would give us time cues back at WCW. He got me all the time, and I was such a mark, I bit on it every damn time. He'd wait until I was really into the match and go, and he'd say, "Nick, check your fly." And every time I'd go right for the zipper, and I'd look like, "Damn it, you got me again." You know, it was just,
who was in your ear most of the time at WCW?
My dad.
Okay.
My dad. Made what for about the most WWE? Part. Gerald Briscoe.
Briscoe was in here?
Yeah.
Who would you rather have, Briscoe or your dad?
Either one. They both ribbed me. So either one.
They both seemed like they were good.
Yeah. They both were ribbers, and they both like to rib me. So either way.
Pastor Tim, this is an interesting one. I saw him over the weekend as well. Thanks for sending the question in. Pastor Tim, he said, humor is subjective, and as a pastor, I intentionally listen to stand-up comedy to balance the heavy experiences I deal with regularly. I appreciate you, Cassio, for sharing your gift of humor, which leads to my question for both you and Nick. Who's on your Mount Rushmore of stand-up comics? He said, my picks are Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle, George Carlin, Sam Kinison, and a bonus pick of Richard Pryor. God bless you guys. And keep bringing smiles to faces and filling hearts with joy. Well, thank you, Pastor Tim. Good to see you this weekend. Boy, that's stand-up comedy is a very subjective art form. That's kind of
so many different styles too. Yeah, I liked the different styles too. I liked Eddie Murphy and back the old school stuff and Richard Pryor. I liked. Carlin. I thought Carlin was good, man.
Sure.
Robin Williams was good. He had a good, right. a great routine. Dave Chappelle cracks me up, man. Some of the skits and the stuff that he does is just unbelievable, man. It's just, I was rolling on a bus, in WWE. I was just bone ass tired, man, and depression and everything. And one of the boys was playing some Chappelle, and I got to see the one where the Rick James skit.
Yeah.
I'd never seen it before, man. And I went from like just sitting there like, oh, damn, man, is this as good as it gets, to laughing my ass off to, I said, hey, give me a beer.
So you're back.
Yeah. So I have to throw Chappelle in there, and there's some, I love some of the newer guys too. If you watch like Whose Line Is It Anyway, Wayne Brady, very funny. The skit he did with Dave Chappelle, where is Wayne Brady gonna have to smack a bitch? It's hard. I'd pick people from different eras, and I would go Eddie Murphy, Pryor, and Steve Martin's another one. You can't go without Steve Martin. I mean, all of those guys from Saturday Night Live back in the day. I mean, you can have a Rushmore of just Saturday Night Live characters, from Belushi.
The Coffins and everything. Yeah, it's very hard to narrow down. And like you said, there's, we've lived long enough to thankfully see different eras of comedy. One of my personal favorites is a guy named Brian Regan. He'll always go up there just as a inspiration when I first started doing it. I love Chappelle. I think he's definitely should be on most people's Mount Rushmore. I like what Ricky Gervais does, that dry English humor. It gets me a lot. I think people.
Benny Hill used to crack me up too.
I think people don't give Jeff Foxworthy enough credit. He is a mastermind with as much material as he comes up with.
Jeff Dunham.
Dunham's great. I've had the pleasure of working with Ron White. He cracks me up all the time. So there's a lot. I mean, the names he mentioned, the names you mentioned, that's why the beauty of stand-up
comedy. We need more than four. We need a bigger mountain, I think.
We need a whole pyramid to just stack them on top of each other. But thank you for the question, Tim. We appreciate that. And Jay Martin, we got a couple more here. Jay Martin says, where does Kurt Angle versus Undertaker No Way Out 2006 rank on your matches that you ever officiated?
Well, with those two, it was awesome. You know, that's anytime you get a chance to work with Undertaker and somebody of Kurt's magnitude too. You know, I never had any problems with Kurt. I thought that Kurt was what I liked about Kurt was his raw instincts. You know, if he went out there and just did reactions, had a skeleton of what he wanted to do, and just reacted, and you know, he was very good, and his wrestling was as solid and as crisp and as any I've ever seen. But sometimes he would overthink things, and he needed somebody to kind of rein him in different times. But and Undertaker was perfect for that. You know, say anybody, that's what a matchup, you know? Yep. Yeah. But that was just one of the, you know, I got to work with so many, you know, Undertaker. Once they get used to comfortable with you, then that's who they want. He always wanted Earl to work with him most of the time, you know, but when he was a Raw, but then when he came, you know, doing SmackDown stuff, then I was the guy that, then he got used to working with me. And it gets to where when you work with him, he can, you know, you can just kind of tell by once by when he looks at you, you can tell him, boom, he'll give you a certain look. You say, okay, boom, you know what he wants, you know, because you work with him enough.
When them two are in the ring together, Kurt Angle and Undertaker, is there a lot of calling stuff, or they just kind of, they're so pro and experienced by then, they're just kind of going with it? Or
they're kind of going with it for the most part. They're going with it.
One of them a planner?
Yeah, well, Angle talks about stuff a lot more. And Undertaker can too. Undertaker can work either way. And I think Kurt could too if he'd relax and give himself the opportunity to. But he likes to talk about everything, you know. But when you're out there working with Undertaker, you follow him and listen, you know. But Kurt had his own, you know, when it's time for you to make your comeback, they're not telling you every step of what to do. You're becoming yourself, you know, and that's when you work with each other at that point in time. I thought they had a great chemistry, to be honest with you. Taker had a great chemistry with just about anybody that he got to work with and got to do, because back then you'd get to do a road trip and guys would do these house shows and to get TV ready, to get the match ready for TV. So you give them different ideas and different stuff to do. So anybody that got to be an opportunity to do that with Undertaker, where you went down, you was working with him every night on a run and then doing stuff on TV, you were being groomed and put into a hell of a spot, man, because that dude is probably the smoothest, best working big guy that I think I worked with, him and JBL. And those two, what great matches those two had with each other too.
Well, 2006, great match. If y'all haven't seen it, go check it out. 30-minute match. It ends when Undertaker tries to put on the triangle choke on Angle, and Angle counters it and rolls him up to retain the title. That was a great match. And
yeah, that was just when Undertaker started first introducing that triangle choke.
Yeah.
You know, because the MMA was starting to come around and people were starting to understand different submissions and stuff more and understand choke holds more. And he wanted to do something different, you know, because he's really into that MMA. So that was the time when he very first started introducing that chokehold that he used.
And last but not least, Adam Kay says, on May 4th, 2002, you were with the Raw brand in England for a pay-per-view as the company was still operating under the WWF banner. Then the next day was the infamous plane ride from hell. But what's interesting is that the following Monday night on May 6th, it was the first TV broadcast under the new name WWE. You recall where you were when you got the official news that you guys were switching names? Had you know the name change was coming? Or was it a complete surprise once you got to Raw that night? Was there a big meeting held by Vince before that night's show to formally address all the talent and the staff and tell them about the name to change? How did all that happen to you?
Well, we knew that there had been a dispute going on with the World Wildlife deal. And they had the rights to it, you know, so they had to change it, and they just made a really good promotion out of it. They just said that, and they sold a ton of shirts to get the F out. Yeah, you know, so they made something, you know, they made a deal out of it. And but it wasn't like a big shock or anything. It was the same company and the same people running it. And, you know, you can call it, but name it whatever you want, you know. But the possibility of it changing, because we knew that, like I said, that other people had had the rights to it. And I guess I'm sure Vince offered them money or whatever, you know, but evidently they weren't interested in that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it wasn't, it really wasn't that big of a deal, you know, and they, you know, like I said, they made money out of it. You know, they found a way to take lemons and turn it into lemonade.
So they just told y'all, you just remember maybe you had,
it wasn't like they had a big meeting about it. You know, we just, you know, back then we was working 300 days a year, you know, just, yeah, you show up TV and okay, so they're going to call us something different now. It wasn't like they brought us all together and says, okay, we're going to get the F out, guys. That, you know, and so I've been ready to get the F out for a long time.
Well, before we get the F out of here, we want to make sure you get a plug in. You got a big show, another one at Das Barbecue in Atlanta, Deep South Wrestling, coming up on the 17th of February, correct?
Yeah, 3 o'clock show again. We're catching them in the daytime while we're still that sunshine I was talking about. And it should be a lot warmer. Should be a lot nicer. I don't really have a list of matches, but I can tell you one thing happened at the birthday bash for Jimma Jewel. She had been picking on poor Professor Payne and C-Dub, and they brought her a big, giant birthday present. And she was wanting accepted presents and was out there, was the queen of the ball. And when they lifted the box up, there stood Xiomara Martinez, our luchador, and she had a birthday cake for Jimma, but she planted it right in her face. Uh-oh. So if you can check that, you can see that on Facebook and on our Deep South website. You can check it out and you can see the whole thing. But Jimma has vowed revenge, man, and when she's put out a deal and said that that you ruined my birthday and I'm going to ruin your career, made the challenge to come out. Whoa. So that should go down. That's going to happen on the 17th. So anxious to see that happen. See Amara. I've seen her go now. She's what, you ever seen a lady that's like that? They seem so cute that you don't really think of them as being a badass because they're cute. Right. But then all of a sudden you see them just take somebody and just beat the crap out of them. And you're like, holy shit. You know, see Amara can do that. I've seen her get mad and just boom, 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 tie. And since she knows submission, you know, she's not just Lucha. Flying Lucha stuff, she gets mad, she'll tie somebody in a knot, and I've seen her do it. So I'm anxious to see, you know, how the 6-foot bombshell does, because CMR is evidently not at least bit afraid, because she planted a cake right in her face and on her birthday. Happy birthday, Jimma.
Happy birthday. So revenge could possibly be had on the 17th of February. That's Das Barbecue, Atlanta, Georgia. Website, if you check it out, it's going to say 5. That's usually what y'all do, but y'all are going to bump it up so y'all can get some of that, make sure it's as warm as possible.
Yeah, we're bumping it up to 3 on Saturday afternoon. So come on down, get there early, get a good seat, and get some food and have a good time, man, because wrestling is free.
We'll check back in on February 12th. So by then, I'm sure you'll have a list of matches and we can get more into that event. Everybody, yes, check them out online. We are... I believe is it We Are Deep South, I believe?
Yes, WeAreDeepSouth.com.
Social media, Deep South Wrestling, it'll pop up as well. Thanks, everybody, for sending in the questions. Nick, man, thanks for the time. This has been fun.
Thank you, man.
We brought up some names we hadn't talked about on here, so some Fit Finley stuff and Ronnie Garvin, so we had some good stuff. We always appreciate y'all's questions. If you're listening to this, go ahead and drop us a line. So we can get to your question next time. For the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Nick Patrick, I'm Cassio. That's another edition of Monday Mailbag.